Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3 and it is time for books, writing and literary culture. This is the half hour called Final Draft. Every weekend where we discover new Australian writing and bring it to you, help you get behind the scenes, between the pages of your favourite books. I have a fantastic interview coming up today with Jane Caro. We will be discussing her latest book. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask, have you discovered the Final Draft podcast? Are you subscribed? Did you catch the special edition episode last week commemorating the life of Peter Corriss? Peter Corriss was, of course, a fantastic Australian writer, famous for the Cliff Hardy series, of which he wrote more than 40 novels. He died at his home Thursday week, and I interviewed him several years ago, and it was a fantastic chat about writing and his characters, and I wanted to share that with you. If you are subscribed to the Final Draft podcast, you get special book-related content like that every week, and I really wanted to share this round, so I was hoping for my listeners out there that you might recommend the podcast to a friend. Get someone else to subscribe and see if we can get this love of Australian books ballooning across Australia, across the globe. Now, today on the show and this week on the podcast, I'm going to be speaking with Jane Caro. She is a commentator, a lecturer, she is an author. And we're going to be discussing the third in her series on the life of Queen Elizabeth. It is called Just Flesh and Blood. And Jane Caro, as a young girl, needed a role model. And Elizabeth I was a strong female that she could look up to. Now, the world is a little bit different now. There are so many strong, iconic women for young girls to look up to. But Jane has chronicled the life of Elizabeth. And this is a fantastic piece of history with one eye on the present. I'm really looking forward to sharing Jane's perspectives with you. It is on Final Draft. You're tuned into 2SER 107.3. And it's coming up after this short break.
You're listening to 2SER, a Sydney-wide broadcaster and strong supporter of local business. Spread the word about your business all over Sydney by sponsoring us. Head to 2ser.com/sponsor today. Stories, ideas, your business and music.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It's books, writing and literary culture every Saturday morning. My name's Andrew Popel and I am joined in the studio by Jane Caro. Jane is an author, she's a commentator, a columnist. I could use a term like Renaissance woman, but it would seem a little naff given our topic today.
Yeah.
Attentive Final Draft fans have heard you, Jane, on the show over the years, discussing your memoir, Plain Speaking Jane, and the second of your Elizabeth series. Today we're here to discuss the final chapter in the reign of Elizabeth I, Just Flesh and Blood. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Now, Just Flesh and Blood, for people, I was actually thinking about this as I was writing my notes, and I was so presumptive of people's knowledge of Elizabeth. I reckon a lot of people would know the name.
Yeah.
Queen Elizabeth's a derrigueur.
Yeah.
This is Queen Elizabeth, first of her name, to borrow some Game of Thrones popular
That's
vernacular.
Right. Yes, yes.
And in Just Flesh and Blood,
House Tudor.
Of House Tudor. Yeah. We've got England's Queen Elizabeth the First, but she's at the end of her life. She's still the Virgin Queen, surrounded by attendants, but they no longer quail at her authority. And Elizabeth ruled between 1558 and 1603, and in Just Flesh and Blood, we pass back and forth. Through her memory, we come to know the woman who understands that beneath the inviolability of her crown, she's always just been just flesh and blood. Mm. So let's get down to brass tacks. This is the third and final book of your series, written from the first person. People familiar with your writing and your commentary know you're enormously engaged on a range of issues, including things like education, women's rights and equality. But where does Elizabeth and her history fit into all of this for you?
Yeah, it's a lot of people find that a bit of a conundrum because, after all, she's a monarch and I'm a Republican. But I always think you have to judge people according to their time. And she was a revolutionary figure. And when I was a young girl, I was desperately looking for heroes, female heroes, role models. And I grew up, I was a child in the 60s, and there just weren't any. There just weren't any. And any that there were, like Joan of Arc or whatever, they all came to a horrible end. You know, there was no one you could look at and say, yes, I want to be like her. Boys, they were thick and far. You know, they were everywhere, male role models that you could sort of aspire to be like or that could encourage you to try things and think that you might have a chance of succeeding. For girls, I think now, pretty much deliberately, there weren't any. And Elizabeth was like a beacon of light. She was like this one, and it's amazing, she was a monarch, but she's a subversive figure because she is a transgressive figure, because she is a woman who ruled. She was an absolute monarch. None of this constitutional malarkey for Elizabeth of Tudor. She was absolute. Her word was law. And she ruled on her own. And she refused to ever marry or have children. And in her period of history, that was a revolutionary act. It simply did not happen.
You've told me about your relationship with Elizabeth. How are you finding, or how have you found, people are engaging with your earlier chapters on Elizabeth's life in Just a Girl and Just a Queen?
Well, people are very kind. I mean, I guess those who hate the book probably just don't bother to tell me that. But
that's a kindness in itself.
Yes, of course it is. Yes,
on the internet age, we rarely get trolls shutting up.
Yeah, exactly. if you're a troll, you get blocked by me. But no, mostly people tell me that they really identify, that they find her life fascinating, that they can really empathise. A lot of people mention the loneliness, the isolation, the fact that she had everything and yet the one thing she could never have was a really close, loving relationship with anyone. Pardon me?
Does it seem that she's resonating as almost a contemporary figure for people, or are they seeing her historically?
No, I think that she's resonating as another human being. Mm. And I'm really pleased with that, because I think we have a tendency in our current era to want to emphasise, and indeed back then we did the same thing, we love emphasising the differences between people. We like to make a big deal about the fact that somebody lived at a different time or has a different colour skin or is a millennial or a baby boomer or any of these nonsensical constructions that we slap around people as convenient
Neither.
Little boxes, exactly. and none of the above, I always say. But I like to emphasise our similarities, which I think are much greater, and that, in fact, the job of the novelist, it seems to me, is to engage in a form of, if you're writing historical novels like I do, time travel, where basically you get people, your reader, to travel through time in their imagination and occupy the skin of someone who lived, you know, centuries before them, but actually understand on an emotional and visceral level what that might have been like. Mm. And that these were just people, just like us, but living in very different circumstances. But it was the circumstances that are different, not the humanity.
Well, I think this relates to my next question, because in Just Flesh and Blood, we have Elizabeth, she's awaiting her death. It's not too much to say she's awaiting her death. She's ruminating on the fact that the end is close, but it's not death in the tower as she might have suspected in her earlier life, but amidst her council, she's at an advanced age. We can speculate over what killed her, and the internet will. And she's casting her mind back across her reign. And in the language you use, the imagery is visceral and it embodies the Queen, from her prowess with the bow to her bodily desires. I mean, she was the Virgin Queen, but that doesn't mean she never felt anything.
No.
How did you want to engage with these contradictions, and especially the virgin mystique that always encompassed her?
The virgin thing is so interesting. It's very hard for modern audiences to believe that she really was a virgin. The first question almost at any session that I do at any kind of festival about her, the first question is, oh, she wasn't really a virgin, was she? Yes, I think she probably was. There's no indication she wasn't, and she was never alone. And the rumours would have been flying, and nothing's ever been substantiated. And if she was fertile, far too dangerous for her to have penetrative sex. Now, that doesn't mean she didn't do all sorts of other things with Robert Dudley. But I think she definitely was a virgin. I think she was, because she didn't want to die in childbirth, and because her father cut her mother's head off, and all sorts of, and she could keep her power that way. There are all sorts of good reasons for her not to want to have sex with a man. But I also think that the thing about the virgin thing was that it was so powerfully clever, but I don't know that she knew that at the time. I think she did it for personal reasons, because she applied her intelligence to a life and she said, this is how to survive. Mm. This is how I keep control over my own destiny. And I saw what happened to my mother when she threw her destiny in with a powerful bloke. Mm. It didn't end well. I need to hold on to my own power, which makes her a very, very contemporary figure in many ways for women. But the other thing is, there's a Protestant Reformation going on. There's a major religious figure that does not make the transition from the Catholic Church to the Protestant Church, and it is the Virgin Mary. Mm. So basically, ordinary English citizens went from worshipping the Virgin Mary to the Virgin Queen. Mm. You can see what a powerful transition object, in a way, she becomes for the population, which accounts for a lot of her popularity. And she was a very modern PR genius. I don't think she got this at the beginning. That's not why she did it. But I think she may have started to realise just what a powerful image it was and how important a figure she became, almost, as I say, supernatural. Mm. It also meant that she could occupy an almost genderless position. Mm. Because I think one of the bases of misogyny is actually male discomfort with their own sexuality. It's not really to do with women. It's to do with men's fear of that sex drive, which, you know, they may feel sometimes, you know, very much under the in the thrall of. And they therefore project that discomfort onto women. And there's a form of self-disgust in the idea of women being these acceptors of male bodily fluids. And the hatred of homosexuality, I think, may well, you know, the fear of it, I mean, may well come out of that as well. There's a sort of weird thing that goes on in a lot of male psyches. Because she was a virgin, she was almost not a woman. Mm. So she could be allowed to be the power.
Yeah.
So I think the virgin thing was actually incredibly important, personally, politically, but also spiritually and psychologically for the English.
It becomes a double-edged sword for her, though, as she has no survivor, she has no succession. Throughout, your Elizabeth is preoccupied, as I'm sure Elizabeth was, she's preoccupied with this underlying concern over succession, how the country will fare. And we now know that England tended to enjoy periods of unheralded stability under its female monarchs. Mm. How would those concerns have felt for Elizabeth, though, on her deathbed, in your imagining and your understanding?
I think because she was such a commonsensical person, which I think is one of the things that has always appealed to me, the sorts of statements she made, like, I don't want to make a window into men's souls. In other words, I don't care what you believe in your heart, just obey the law. Mm. You know, another time she spat out at somebody who was having some sort of religious, you know, debate, you know, there is but one Lord Jesus, the rest is a dispute over trifles. So she had a very pragmatic, commonsensical approach to things. And I think by the end of her life, she knew who her successor was. She had for a very long time. It was James VI of Scotland, who then became James I of England, Mary Queen of Scots' son. But she also knew that if she ever named him officially, that would open the door for a whole lot of people to say, what do we want this old bat for? Let's get it. Men should be in charge. It's the natural way of things. God ordains that men should be in charge. Let's fetch him and get rid of her. So she recognised that to survive, it was better not to officially name him. But I think she knew really from the moment that his mother was executed and he would be the person who inherited her throne if he survived longer than she did. Mm-hmm. So at the end, she knew that was going to happen. But I think she'd also come to the point where she realised she'd done what she could do. And that, you know, the future, as I have her say, was no longer any business of hers. But she knew that the transition would happen easily because there was no competition. He was it. Mm. By not having any children of her own or any daughters, for example, she decomplicated the succession.
You're enjoying books, writing and literary culture on 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft and my name's Andrew Popel. I'm in conversation right now with Jane Carrow and we are discussing the third in her series on Queen Elizabeth I of England, Just Flesh and Blood. We're going to take a track right now. This is a fantastic new one from Anna Calvi. It's a little bit apt to our conversation. And then we're going to be back with the rest of my conversation with Jane Carrow. So this right now is Anna Calvi. It's called As a Man.
I was a man. was a man. As a man.
You're on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. And right there, that was Anna Calvi with As a Man. Now, you are on Final Draft. This is Books, Writing and Literary Culture. And my name's Andrew Popel. I'm speaking with Jane Carrow about her new novel, Just Flesh and Blood. It chronicles the last chapter in the life of Elizabeth I. And we're going to discover a little bit more now about the contemporary resonances of Elizabeth's reign. Now, Jane, we're cursed to live in interesting times.
But, so is she.
But not as interesting as they could be, because as I read over my notes from 3.5 years ago, and when we spoke over Just a Queen, I realised that, so we had, when we chatted, we talked about Elizabeth's struggle with a lack of female representation and peers in her cabinet. Now, here we are, days out from Julie Bishop decrying the same circumstances in her own party. You're Elizabeth in Just Flesh and Blood. She mourns the loss of her peers, but I sensed a particular sense of loss for political sisters, people like Jane Grey. We're talking about this still.
Well, it's because when you come from a subordinate group and women remain a subordinate group, then there are always only a very few of you who get to be in decision-making positions at any time. Now, you can either compete with those other women, and some people take that way of doing it, the queen bee, you know, I'll be the only woman at the table. But I think most women don't. I think that they look for a kind of company and companionship and solidarity with the few other women that are in a similar position to them. And it has always been thus. I mean, Catherine de' Medici and Elizabeth I had a they wrote letters to each other constantly. They had a friendship. Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth were rivals for the same throne. That made it very difficult. But with, pardon me, I've got a froggy voice today. Catherine of Medici, they never met again, but they had this friendship, a supportive friendship. The other thing that reveals to me that the few peers she had, other queens, were important, and that's why, of course, shopping Mary, Queen of Scots was so awful. She ended up killing a sister, you know, and it was her closest living relative as well, was that there's tapestries that all those queens owned, woven from the illustrations in a book written in 1405. This is how long feminism's been going that we know of, 1405, by a woman called Christine de Pizan, a French writer, who wrote about the Book of the City of the Ladies, which is basically a feminist fantasy of a city with the high walls to keep men out that only women were in, and they built it. Mm. And the tapestries are all of women poring over blueprints and planing wood and, you know, putting blocks of bricks into walls. I mean, and they're dressed in their conical medieval hats. I mean, it takes you to a place where you think, my goodness, they had seditious thoughts just as we do now. And so I think that there was a sense of loneliness and separation because they could never meet. But there was also a sense of we have things in common. We know what it is to be this peculiar creature, a woman with power, in a world full of men who basically think that you're absolutely inferior. I mean, their attitudes to women were appalling. They didn't see them as much better than cows, and who are constantly feeling that you are illegitimate in your position of power. I think exactly the same attitudes operate today. The liberal right does not take Julie Bishop seriously as a candidate for the leadership of that party because they don't take women seriously. They regard women in a very old-fashioned patriarchal way that women are supposed to cook meals, bear children, and do what they're told.
What we're discussing here, though, requires a complete rethink, not just of Liberal Party pre-selection, but the way we're actually running society, because you're talking about a collegial, not a figureheaded type leadership framework. I mean, it is truly revolutionary, and that sort of thing that's hard to get off the ground. Is there a critical mass we need to reach?
Look, it's almost starting. It's the very reason that we're seeing people like Trump, who is manifestly unsuitable for the position he now holds, that we are seeing people like Nigel Farage and Steve Bannon and what's his name Duterte in Manila and Erdogan in Turkey, is because in fact they are the last vestiges of that old style of straight white male control. Today's not white, but straight male control of societies. In much the same way as in Elizabeth's time, the Catholic Church became much more vicious after the Protestant Reformation. That's when the Spanish Inquisition, for example, occurred, because it was desperately trying to hang on to the power that it had always had because it sensed it was losing it. Well, that's exactly what's going on now. The old group, privileged men generally, who was just assumed they had fast entree to leaderships of power, positions of power, have sensed that they are losing that the other groups, people of colour, women, LGBTQI people, are actually moving up. A friend of mine describes the feeling amongst older blokes now, the more conventional type blokes, is the moving train effect. So if you've ever been on a stationary train at a platform and another train comes past you, you feel like you're going backwards even though you're not. You're staying still. It's simply that the train is going by. And he says they're not going backwards, but it feels like they are to them because other people are coming up and they're resisting like crazy. There's been some research come out just the last couple of days from Broad Agenda, which says that there's a backlash amongst millennial, if you believe in those things, but anyway, that's how they describe it, millennial men who are saying that, you know, women are getting extra advantages, that it's not fair, they're being left behind. That's actually not so, demonstrably not so, but that's what it feels like. Yeah. When you used to have all the advantages and now you're starting to find yourself in a more equal playing ground. Elizabeth was dealing with exactly those same pressures. Julie Bishop is facing them. Hillary Clinton fell as a result of them. Julia Gillard probably fell as a result of them. But those pressures aren't going away, just as the Protestant Reformation didn't go away, and eventually the Catholic Church ended up being just another branch of Christianity. It no longer had the complete power over all information and culture that it had had up until the 1500s. We're going through the same sort of transition, and for the same reason. Back then, it was because of the invention of the printing press. Now, it's because of the invention of the internet. It's technology that smashes power bases every single time.
I'm speaking with Jane Carrow, and we are discussing the third in her series on the life of Elizabeth I. It is Just Flesh and Blood. And so I'm not going to discourage you from reading this, but to say that you should actually start at Just a Girl and work your way through. Jane, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me. We are discussing Just Flesh and Blood. It's the third in the Elizabeth series, and I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. I loved coming. Thank you.
Australian Music Week brings the best new homegrown and international talent back to Sydney. At Cronulla Beach from November 7 to 11, it's Australia's most accessible grassroots music industry conference. See over 150 live shows, from indie pop and electronica to rock and folk. Catch Australia's only dedicated music film festival, plus 20 panels and masterclass workshops. Tickets on sale now from just $25. 2SER is a proud media partner of Australian Music Week.
This is 2SER 107.3, where you're listening to Final Draft for but a few minutes longer. My name's Andrew Popel, and I want to say thank you to Jane Carrow, who joined me today discussing her new book, Just Flesh and Blood. If you would like more of that conversation, and trust me, there is more, we have so much to discuss about genre and politics and how it relates to the Elizabethan era. Check out the podcast. The full conversation with Jane will be going up, and you can get so much more. There's also a tribute to Peter Corris, and if you're enjoying it, what I really love for you to do this week is recommend it to two friends. Help share the love of Australian literature by recommending it to two friends, and hopefully they'll recommend it to two friends, and just it's going to grow. Now, I forgot for a second that The Vulture's Nest is coming up next, but they are, and I'm going to leave you with some new Iron and Wine, because I love a little bit of Iron and Wine. Maybe it's because I've got a beard. This is Iron and Wine with Last of Your Rock and Roll Heroes. I'm Andrew Popel. I'll see you next week for more Final Draft.
Someday you're doing your thing. Someday you blame it on the company and a couple of drinks. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Someday you say what you feel. Someday you say it just to feel another hand on the wheel. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Like they're gone. Tired of the kind of nothing you got to lose. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Someday you're making a fist. Someday you give away everything till you know what to miss. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Like they're gone. Sinking for stone. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Like the last of your rock and roll heroes are gone. Someday you turn to your friends. Someday they know why you stood up, turned into the wind. Like the last of your